Blog Talk Radio.
To an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie ahead, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. Doing great.
Stephen, if I could, I'd like to begin tonight's show with a few words about Blog Talk Radio.
Okay.
You know, we've been using Blog Talk Radio for many years, and we've done hundreds of shows with them, and by and large, we've had a very positive experience with Blog Talk Radio. Would you agree with that?
I would say by and large. It's the beta that never ends, but yeah, okay,
by and large. It's the beta that never ends, and it's got some lovable foibles like the glitch of the week, right, which we've always looked forward to, sometimes our fault, sometimes their fault. Sometimes it's been the fault of Skype and other things, but by and large, we've had a very positive experience with Blog Talk Radio, except for one kind of unfortunate incident which happened very recently, and we got past it, and all's been well. So I want to just lay that out, that it's been a good relationship with Blog Talk Radio, before I provide the following pet peeve. Okay, this is a bit of an annoyance. Okay, so. Our program this evening is called 10 Things You Don't Know About the Future. Now, when I typed the title in on Blog Talk Radio, I skipped the word no. My mistake. Granted, I made the mistake. Saved the show without realizing it. Came back a moment later, added the word no. But unfortunately, the link from Blog Talk Radio now transmitted all through social media and everywhere I reproduce it says that the name of the show is 10 Things You Don't About the Future. So that's not great. And I would just like to say to our friends at Blog Talk Radio, anything you can do about that would be awesome. And I'm not even mentioning the Philip Van Netterveld thing, because we've talked about that a number of times, and I'm not going to talk about
the Phantom episode. Okay. Well, this is the Phantom Word.
That was the loss of the greatest hour of radio in broadcasting history, I think. That's been established, so there's nothing else to say. Now, the other
you joined fine company here, Phil. When Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, the prepared line was, "That's one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind."
Right.
Now, I believe that he probably flubbed it just slightly. He said, "That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind," leaving out that crucial A.
Right.
Identifying, that it was one small step for him.
Right.
But, when they go back and, the plaque and everything in NASA or whatever, they always put the A in there, and we just sort of, pretend that A was always there. And so that's what we'll do with this episode, Bill. We'll just, we know that the no is supposed to be there. So.
Well, I appreciate the Neil Armstrong comparison. Okay, that's nice. but at least his dropped word sentence still scanned and made sense. Okay, it's, this is...
Yeah.
this is a little harder than that. Okay, the other thing I just want to point out, and we'll fix this, okay, because I know Blog Talk Radio is probably not going to fix this. But when we put announcements up, it puts the player in social media, and people click on the player, and nothing happens until the show goes live. So it's like you have to put in social media, this thing's going to happen later, don't click the player, or something like that. Because I keep getting these feedback from people, hey, you put an empty show up there. It's like, well, no, it's supposed to be a link to the show.
You will enjoy it much better after we started talking.
yeah, you get these little sarcastic, hey, it only lasted 2 seconds. You know? And it's like, yeah, but boy, that was the 2 seconds that'll change your... You know what you get when you click on that before the show is you get the Blog Talk Radio, right? That's all you hear. which, you know, is not great. But enough about those problems. There, I've vented. It's off my chest. And now I want to talk about 10 things you don't know about the future. And I did hedge this in the description. I said 10 things you probably don't know about the future. Because you know what? A lot of our listeners will know at least some of these things. And then I hedged further and said,
we have a sophisticated audience, don't we?
We do. We have a very sophisticated audience. And I took it one step further and said, if there's even one item on this list that you haven't heard yet, it could change everything. So I feel like our bases are covered, right? First I said, okay, probably you don't know them all. Then I was like, we still win there's, you know, just one that you don't know. Okay, so we're going to talk about 10 things you don't know about the future, as we often do. We divvied this up. I get to do 5. You get to do 5. As I had hoped, we took it in somewhat different directions. I'm going to talk about things people don't know about the future, in quotes, and you're going to talk about things that are going to happen in the future that people don't know about. So I'm going to sort of talk about the nature of the future. You're going to talk about the substance, the contents of the future, if you will.
Yeah, and we do this. It's funny. We do our show preps, obviously, completely separately, and so it's always interesting how it all comes together. And so, yeah, going in two opposite directions should make it a little more interesting. So,
I think so. Complementary directions, I would say. Hardly opposite.
Yeah.
Opposite would be if you tell 10 things you don't know about the past, right? Or you're ready. Here's 5 things you do know about the future, by golly. I'll show Phil. Right, that would have been awesome. that would have been kind of fun, too, actually, come to think of it. That would be the easier – that would actually be pretty tough, right? 10 things you do know about the future. Right? Maybe next week. It's always tough coming up with these topics.
Time keeps on ticking.
Okay, so I'll start off. I've got my first two are actually variations on the same theme. So my first thing I want to say about the future is there's more future than you think, probably. There's probably more future than you think. If you were to just take a guess, if you don't know what the projections are, if someone were to tell you, well, you know, the world is so many years old, how old would you say the world is? I think most people would guess that the world is at about in the middle of its cycle, or is somewhere near the end of its cycle, right? That we live on a middle-aged to old planet, not a particularly young planet and not a super old planet, but somewhere in the middle to old, because we have been around a long time, and you're going to start talking in billions of years, if you don't know. Now, what we do know is that the Earth is about 4.5 billion years old, and that it has about 5 billion years more to go, at least is one estimate. So, in fact, if you thought it was about in the middle, you're pretty close. And when I say there's more future than you think, if you were guessing that it's got about as much future as it had past, you were right. So, so it's hard to back up on the life of the Earth. But then if we look at the life of the universe, the universe, of course, is quite a bit older. And as we all know from the opening theme of the Big Bang Theory, it's about 14 billion years old. From the time of the Big Bang until now. Now, how much future does the universe have in front of it? 14 billion years, do you think, Stephen?
Yeah, I would guess about as much time in front of us as we have behind us.
That and more. Okay, actually, the estimates I'm using came from a really cool article in National Geographic, and I'll put this in the show description. Time will end – oh, excuse me, that was not the one I wanted. This is time will end in 5 billion years. I wanted – I thought I had another one here. I don't have – darn it, I don't have the link I wanted. There is another article that I'll have to go back and find that was in National Geographic that cites all of these statistics I'm about to get. Okay, it gives the physicist rundown on where the future of the universe is going. And yes, we've been around for about 14 billion years, and that is not even a tip of the iceberg of how long they project the universe will be around. In fact, we've got another 3 trillion years before you can start to mark before you get to what you might call the beginning of the end of the universe. 3 trillion years. So a billion, of course, is 1,000 million. A trillion is 1,000 billion. So we're at 14 billion years now. In 3,000 billion years, our galaxy will be alone in space, meaning that all the other galaxies will have moved so far away that if you're on a planet in the Milky Way galaxy and you look up into the night sky, all you'll be able to see is Milky Way, right? Everything else will be gone. And that's kind of the beginning of the end. It's like, okay, in the article, I'll have to find the link and get that up there. In the article, they refer to that as the death of cosmology. Okay, it's the beginning of the end. Now, much later, 100 trillion years from now, the last star will die out. Okay, the last star will stop nuclear fusion. There won't be any stars lighting up the sky. Still, a long time before the universe is over, there's a big gap now and between the last star burning out and the end of matter as we know it. Actually, the end of regular matter occurs in 10 to the 30th power year. So that's a 10 followed by 30 zeros years. I don't know. Do you know the number? What that number is called, Stephen? I don't know off the top of my head. It's
no, I don't.
It's a bazillion or something. And then you get to the final the final mark, the end of the black holes. Okay, the black holes will still be there, and they're going to slowly leak out radiation over the eons, and all black holes will finally finish doing whatever they're going to do in about 10 to the 100th power years. And I believe 10 to 100th power is called a Google. I believe that's the inspiration for the name of the internet company we all know so well, although it's spelled G-O-O-G-O-L, Google. So, and introduced to me
Google
as a child
play,
is like the biggest number they had ever named, right? And then there's the Googleplex, which is like a Google to the power of a Google or something like that. But anyway, so basically all that's to say is there's a lot of future in front of us, more than there is past, that the future is big beyond imagining. And the fact that even the stars will burn out doesn't mean we'll be gone. Our planet may go, but we might live on another planet. Stars may burn out, but we may find another mode of existence that's compatible with, say, black holes. You know, if you can live in a black hole, man, you got basically a Google to live. So, I mean, you get a lot of years to live. So there's a lot of future in front of us. There's more future than you think. That's my first thing that people probably don't know about the future.
A young universe.
Give us something. We're in an extremely young universe. We're in the first blink of this universe, basically.
That is awesome. Okay. All right. We one thing we live in right now is a world that is shaped by limited resources, limited energy specifically. A little bit of trouble in the Middle East, our gas prices spike, oil spikes. That's not necessarily what we're going to be seeing in the future. We're going to have solar voltaic technology. We're likely to reach what is called the solar singularity within a couple of decades, and that is when the price of power produced with solar arrays falls below that of the price of power on the grid. And when that happens, that's sort of an important point. People will be able to produce their own power, on the roofs of your homes and things like that in a way that makes sense. It makes sense. It would make sense for everyone to do it at that point. You're not just remote houses that can't hook up to the grid, and not just people that are you know, are getting some sort of tax rebate, and not just people that are ecologically minded. You know, I don't have anything against the people that are you know have solars for have solar for those purposes, but just the people that are you know minding their pennies will say, you know what,
people will do it because it's the smart thing to do, right?
They won't have
to be particularly good people, right? Or they won't be pursuing any goal other than just powering their homes, basically. That's exactly.
Even the bad people will have solar at that point, not just the righteous.
And that's
an important point at which we stop depending so much on things that are not renewable, and we move towards the things that are renewable. Not just because it's better for the planet, but because it's cheaper. There's just so much of it. And that's a huge, huge change in the way we will have energy. And also, the very fact that it's cheap means that we will use more of it. So we'll have more access to more energy, too.
Ultimately, free energy is free everything, right? And so cheaper energy is cheaper everything. If you get to the point where you're essentially not paying for it, which, if you get to the point where you're just kind of collecting it on your roof, you're closing in on that. This is going to be one of the big drivers behind the whole move to post-scarcity, the whole move to a world of abundance. Let me ask you a couple questions about the solar singularity that you've described. First off, consumption of energy, I think you referenced this just in your last comment, but I want to test this. The solar singularity means that we will have energy equal to our current levels of consumption in 20 years produced by solar, or we'll have what we're consuming then, right, produced by solar. That's the thing that hangs up. Would it actually be able to support all the energy we'll need by then? Because our energy consumption needs are probably only going to increase, right?
I think that our energy needs will increase, but the solar singularity is not about the amount of energy that's produced. It's about dollars spent for energy versus the grid. Okay.
Oh, okay.
And so there are actually places in the world that have reached the solar singularity already. Places like Hawaii, for example, all of their power has traditionally been from diesel generators. You can imagine a city the size of Honolulu running off of a diesel generator, how expensive electricity would be in a place. And so, and of course they have plenty of sunshine. So, you know, if the comparison is against a diesel generator versus, you know, solar power in a place that has plenty of sunshine, then you can see how easy it is to reach the solar singularity in places like Hawaii.
Right.
Obviously, far northern countries are going to be the last to reach the solar singularity, where the price of solar compares favorably with the price of grid power. And so that's not even.
Not an economist, but I guess implicit to me, not an economist once again, implicit in the idea that the cost has gone down below the cost of something else, is the idea that there's sufficient quantity of it, right? That it replaces, I don't know, some huge chunk of it, or ultimately could replace all of it. But I would leave it to the economists of the solar singularity to explain that piece of it. But for the price to go down that low, it's got to be vastly available at that point. There's got to be a lot of solar energy available. Yeah.
About this, one of the things that you can solve a lot of problems if you get solar down low enough in cost. And one theorist was saying, you know what, we could even solve the CO2 problem. And how's that? Well, you know, you take a place like the Sahara Desert. Take 1% of the Sahara Desert and cover it with. That we're talking about 100 billion square meters would be 1% of the Sahara Desert. Right. And you cover that with photovoltaic arrays, and you use that to basically filter CO2 out of the atmosphere and put it in solid carbon, basically coal, I guess, is how you would end up storing it, right? And you could solve the problem, of CO2 in the atmosphere with that much power. And it provided you could obviously can't do that now. There's not enough, it's just too expensive. But if you get solar low enough, you could start addressing things like that. If a place like California is drying up, and it's cheap enough, you could use solar power to run desalinization plants and get your water straight from the ocean. There's all kinds of things, there's all kinds of problems that can be solved if you get solar, the renewable power like solar costs low enough.
It comes to the point that kind of what I was saying before, energy is just upstream of so many other things. It's upstream of abundance in many different forms, and the abundance of capability, the abundance to solve problems easily that are currently vexing to us. We talk about throwing money at problems to make them go away. And throwing energy at problems is kind of the species level equivalent of that. And how can you throw energy at a problem? Well, you have to have enough energy to throw it at it. And what you're talking about is us getting to the point where we do have enough energy to throw at these big problems. I always like the geoengineering solutions to climate, because I think that any mess we made accidentally over centuries of industrialization is something best approached in a non-gradual way, right? It's best approached by a real engineering fix. So those solutions always appeal to me.
Yeah.
All right, solar singularity. I like it. I think there's a lot of people right now, Stephen, you know what they're saying? I did not know that.
I'm hopeful.
That's what they're saying.
Yeah. I'm hopeful that lives up to the title of the show. What's your next one?
I've got another one about there being more future than you think. I said the first two were kind of related, but this one takes us in a different direction, because there's more future than you think, not for the universe, but for each of us. And this is something that we reference actually in the opening to every show, but I think not a lot of people have really gotten their heads around this. We talk about this quite a bit, but the point is that complexity and rapid change actually amount to more rapid movement through time. So a person who lived to be 100 years old, who was born in 1905, who died in 2005, effectively lived through much more change than someone who was fortunate enough to live to be 100, who was born in, like, say, 1105 and died in 1205, right? They effectively went through centuries and centuries worth of change at the rate change had been occurring in prior eras of human history. And what this means is each of us is currently living in an era of rapid change, great complexity, great connectedness, and it means that we're all going to see even bigger changes going forward than we've seen up to this point. And it means we'll see more change, more rapid change. Stephen, one of the things we talk about is how things that we talked about coming in the future have shown up, and how they've not only shown up, but they've become almost commonplace, and then there's multiple variations of them, things like electric cars, things like self-driving cars. Just the amazing number of planets that have been discovered, right? A lot of different things that show us either gaining knowledge or gaining capability or just experiencing things so much faster than people did in previous eras. Now, there's some people who challenge this idea, who challenge the idea that we're that we're accelerating. There are those who argue that the big accelerations in technology occurred actually in the previous century, and the things have now slowed down. You hear that. You hear that from time to time. I actually don't agree with that. I think that's not true. I think that the change that's occurring now is of a different sort. We had this huge shift in just raw industrial capability that occurred a couple of centuries ago, over about 150 years. And then we had this huge shift of information processing capability that came online starting about really, I mean, we started doing interesting things with information, 70 years ago or something like that. Really about the time of World War II, I think, the very earliest stages of that. And then something else that we talk about pretty frequently on the show, those two things started working together. And we started seeing what I call the datafication of the world, one species of which, Stephen, is what you call the coffee shopification of the world. And right. In fact, we're seeing more profound change today, I think, than we have at any other time, but we're not seeing the big industrial impressive-looking change. So the big building skyscrapers and building bridges and building dams, we're kind of taking a break from that because we're merging these previous two eras of change into something new. When they get fully merged, then look out. Then things really are going to accelerate. And people living at that time are going to look at this time and think that we were living in a relatively slow period, like the guy born in 1105 who dies in 1205. That's how much faster it will be. So I think accelerating change actually implies that there's just a lot more future coming, even if you're old, right? Even if you're, I'm 52, right? Traditionally speaking, I don't have that much runway in front of me, not as much as I did when I was, say, 22. But I actually think that my expectation for seeing things happen and for possibilities even that I can realize is greater at age 52 than it was for a 22-year-old living even 50, 60 years ago. So there's a lot of future out there. There's a lot of years to come yet, and more importantly, there's a lot of change that's going to be occurring inside those years.
The time between salient events keeps shrinking and shrinking and shrinking so that you live more as far as the amount of future you see in a shorter period of time than ever before. So it's an exciting time to be alive. Okay.
We might extend our lives and, you know, then all
that.
Yeah.
And then exactly. Okay. So number two for me, again, coming at this, this a whole different way than, Bill, than, and so I guess this will work out. Batteries.
Go.
Okay, so you know, we I talked about solar and how it'd be great to use a renewable power. Well, wouldn't it be great if you could use that power anytime you wanted to? Of course, we have batteries now, but how about batteries, Phil, that are 10 times better? How about batteries that are 100 times better? Batteries that are 100 times better are approaching the theoretical maximum based on the chemistry that we use, that we're currently using, like lithium ion and things like that. But you can imagine that, you know, we have cars now that run on these batteries. Imagine a battery that could hold 100 times as much power than the current batteries. You can see why guys like Elon Musk, who's busy trying to take us into outer space, is also equally interested in batteries. You know, I mean, Tesla is as much a battery company as it is a car company. It's building this big mega factory for batteries, and he's pushing the limits with his R&D, and he's actually sharing a lot of this R&D. Which is a little unusual for private companies like this. So,
absolutely. Well, you remember when we first heard of the Tesla, right? We've been around long enough that the Tesla is an example of one of those things that went from something that was predicted to a thing that's just part of everyday reality. You know, I saw one on the road the other day, and you see them once in a while. The the description of the Tesla when it was first introduced, the first idea that was floated was basically Elon Musk is going to build cars using a whole bunch of laptop batteries, right? Do you remember that? That's what they were. That's what they were saying.
Yeah.
That's what they were saying about the Tesla. Now, I don't think that the current Model S has a bunch of laptop batteries in there. I think it's got some one or two or however many very powerful batteries in there. But you make that battery 100 times more powerful. And, yeah, there's two directions you can go in that, right? You can have a car that's 100 times more powerful, which is just like, what? You know, I mean, because it's already a screaming fast car. Or you've got a car with a battery that's, you know, 1% of the size. Right, and suddenly the whole weight, I mean, everything about it is changed. Or a car that can go 100 times longer, perhaps, without having to be recharged. All of those, you know, are just extraordinary developments. Probably the third one is the biggest one, right? Because when you think about a car, range, you can go 300 miles or, is the math, am I doing the math right? 30,000 miles if it would last 100 times longer. You know, drive it around the Earth once, and then you got to recharge again. Jeez, every time you go around the whole planet.
You know, at that point, you stop worrying about whether there's going to be a recharging station wherever it is that you drive, right? I mean,
exactly.
You know, you recharge less often than you would change oil in your current vehicle. You also just don't even worry.
Time was you were lucky to get a transmission to last 30,000 miles, right? And we're essentially talking about a tank of gas getting you there. That's amazing. And by the way, Teslas don't have transmissions; they don't need them, which is one of the cool things about Teslas. But I don't mean to get this onto Tesla and off the battery, just to give an example of what that means when a battery holds 100 times as much. Yeah. So let's get the solar thing going. And let's start charging up some much, much more powerful batteries.
Awesome. All right. Yeah. What's your number three, Phil?
I love it. Okay. Number three. I have to come back to it. I got excited about Teslas, and I was looking at something there. All right. Okay. I've already said that there may be more future than you think. How about an infinite amount of future? And no, I'm not talking in metaphysical terms. I'm not talking in spiritual terms. If you want to talk about that, we don't cover that on this show. A lot of reasons to believe that might be the case anyhow, and that's cool. But I'm talking just strictly or almost strictly in physical terms here, that the universe could be infinite. And one, even for beings like us, I mean, there's an argument that says, well, yeah, the universe is probably infinite in duration, but even, you know, our universe won't last long enough, so we'll be gone. Even if, you know, using my earlier, well, you know, we can figure out a way to live in black holes and then we're set, right? Because we can make it for 100 to the 10 to the 100th power years. And the point is, that's still not forever. And there is one model that has been proposed that I've heard of whereby basically human beings or human-like beings that live in this universe could experience infinite time subjectively. And this was proposed by Frank Tipler in his book, The Physics of Immortality. Now, the reason I have to now hedge about whether we're talking about metaphysics and religion is that Tipler pushes this idea all the way into the area of religion and, in fact, into the area of Christianity. And basically, in his book, The Physics of Immortality, he explains how advanced physics merges with Christianity. Well, I'm not going to take it that far tonight. I'm just going to describe one of the core ideas he has about once we go to virtual physics heaven, basically. The way that works is we put ourselves just outside the event horizon of a black hole. And we slow time subjectively to zero. Now, the truth is that if you're moving into a black hole from the perspective of an observer, right, they will see you eventually fall into it, and you'll go through it. But from your perspective, and, you know, the great thing about Einstein's theory of relativity, paradoxical as it may seem, is that all perspectives are equally valid, right, from the point of view that it's occurring. From your perspective, time slows to zero. So in Tipler's vision of the very, very, very advanced future, humanity, you know, we've become digital beings, and we're living in an unbelievably wonderful simulation, which is essentially heaven. And where we've located this unbelievably wonderful simulation is in a computer, which is doing exactly that thing. It's breaching the event horizon of a black hole. Time has slowed to zero, and bingo, we get to live forever. So there's at least one model where you can get you can squeeze infinite time out of the universe. So if you didn't like the fact that a lot of stuff is going to happen even in your lifetime, and if you didn't like the fact that the universe is going to last potentially 10 to the 100th power years, this is the best offer I can make, okay? An infinite subjective universe. How could I offer more than that, Stephen? I ask you, how can I make the universe last longer than infinity?
And in the universe could be whatever you want to make it at that point. If you're living in a virtual reality in a computer on the event horizon of a black hole. You know, it's interesting, Phil, that you would say that because, the weirdness of the movie Interstellar. I read an article about that and said that, well, a very advanced civilization would be very interested in living at on the event horizon of a black hole. It actually makes a little bit of sense. That he would encounter, spoiler alert for Interstellar. Sorry. He would encounter a civilization that was very advanced at where he did. So. I think that's interesting. That's actually been thought of by some pretty smart guys. So yeah,
there you go. And in fact, it's unclear to me in Interstellar whether that's some other advanced race, right, or some other advanced group, or is that future us, right? That's living there, because time gets very wonky in Interstellar. Sorry, we're spoiling Interstellar, but we've already done that. Listen, if you listen to this show every week, we spoiled Interstellar months ago. So, you know, if you haven't had it spoiled for you yet, surprise. That's what we like to do. But yeah, I think that idea gets some traction. I mean, the thing about black holes and the thing about a singularity. The thing about just the laws of physics almost seeming to break down makes for great fiction, and it makes for great speculative scenarios. But the wonderful thing about Tipler and his calculations, disagree with his conclusions all you want, and most people do. Okay, most people don't come to the same conclusions Tipler does. He bases it on physics. The man is a physicist. You know, he is not a theologian or a pop philosopher who decided he would throw some physics into his arguments to make them more interesting. This guy did serious, important theoretical work in physics all his life, and this is the idea that it led him to. So, it makes for not only a great speculation about where the future may be going, but as you point out, Stephen, it makes for some great fiction as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yep.
All right, we're moving along here. I think we might make it to all 10 if we keep plowing through. What else we got for us, Stephen?
Keep trucking.
Yeah.
Personalized medicine. Okay.
All right.
This is something we talk about from time to time on this show. But this is a big deal that I don't know that's been fully, digested by the public at large. That when people look back on the time we're living in now, it'll be the dark ages of medicine. Because in the future, if you come down with something, if you're fighting off a cancer, your doctor will not just fight that particular cancer, but a sub type of cancer. It'll have it classified down to the very cancer that's in your body that has never been seen quite like that before in anybody else. Because cancer is kind of like a snowflake. It's that unique from person to person, And so and then not just fighting that cancer, but fighting it in the best way to deal with it within your body, not just anyone's body, but yours specifically. You know, that's when you personalize medicine to that level, you know, the outcomes are so much better. I mean, your chances of beating it completely go way up, and the process of getting there, where the medicine itself doesn't make you sick the same way. You don't have the same side effects when you're targeting something that well. So that's something to look forward to, Phil. This is and not just cancer, but everything, every medical problem that we face as society will be personalized. Not just the problem, but also the human body in which the problem is found will be personalized.
Wow.
And so
it's an amazing thought. When you think about medicine, we know. Of course we know that no two people are the same. And we know that the course of even the same disease in two different people can be very, very different, right? Or even in the same person who gets it more than once. We know that medicine is based on abstracting and generalizing. It has to be. I mean, it has always had to be. There is no luxury. The idea of making it individually about this individual who has this instance of this disease was, to use the word luxury is just, it was preposterous in any previous time. But it's not preposterous anymore. It is the future of medicine. It's where we're going.
And the fun thing about this, a great thing about this, don't have to give up. We're not just going to say, well, to heck with old medicine and embrace something completely untested and untried. We get there with incremental steps.
Right.
I mean, we're already beginning to use some personalized medicine in some areas. This is just a little bit better medicine than what we had before. And we get more and more and more personalized towards the disease itself and towards fighting it in particular. Subpopulations. You deal with diseases, that in certain genetic groups a little bit differently now already than you do, in other groups, but that's just going to become more and more the case until you'll be your own genetic group, Phil. Because there's no one else is quite exactly like you, and doctors should, personalize their medicine to the disease and to the person,
because of the automated component of this, there will be a whole body of knowledge just around you, Stephen. The course of disease running through you, just around your genetic profile, and just around what's going to work for you and what's likely to work for you as an individual, rather than the kind of broad strokes that. By necessity, we've had to paint with before.
I would say, Phil, that here's one of my bold statements of the evening.
Well, let's hear it.
There'll be more medical knowledge about you, Phil, than there was about the world as a whole 50 years ago.
Wow. And when are you going to stick a date on that one?
Yeah, let me throw a date on it. I'll throw 15 years on this one.
Okay, all right. I think that's not at all unlikely. I think I'm always wrong when I disagree with you on these predictions anyhow, Stephen, so I wouldn't presume. But especially this one, that sounds about right. That sounds about right. Within about 15 years, each individual patient will have a body of data, a body of knowledge built up around the care and treatment of that person.
If you were to print it out and put it in book form, it'd fill the same libraries that were filled with medical knowledge 50 years ago. Of all medical knowledge.
So, absolutely.
Yeah.
Wow. So we've got that to look forward to. And naturally, we'll need machines to deal with all that data.
Of course. It'll all
really big brain.
Yeah. Exactly. That's what we'll have, isn't it? You know, that's why we have to send Watson to medical school, right? So
exactly, yeah. This will be. Can you imagine Watson's great great grandchildren 15 years from now? These will be some very smart computers, and they'll need to be, because you know what? I'm not getting any younger, and 15 years from now, I'm going to need a lot of help. So let's get cracking on that stuff, Ivy.
Absolutely. Okay, what's your number four?
All right. I got another one. Here's something you may not know about the future. You probably don't know about the future. Did you know, Stephen, that the future may have already happened? Okay. And this is, you know, spoiler alert for most of the good movies made about kind of dystopian futures in the 90s, right? Because that was that was the shocking thing that you would discover, for example, in The Matrix. It's like, well, you think you're living in late 20th century, but in fact, the late 20th century was a couple of centuries ago. A whole bunch of stuff has happened since then, and you're living in a simulation of the late 20th century, because that already occurred, and the world has been rebuilt as a computer simulation. Well, as we have discussed on more than one occasion, there are reasons to believe, solid philosophical reasons to believe, that the universe we're living in might very well be a computer simulation. It's not just a fantasy scenario. It's not just a couple of you know, sci-fi heads geeking out here. I mean, the show is that, but that's not the only reason to believe it. There are some interesting philosophical and statistical reasons to believe that we may be living in a simulation. The short version of the argument is this. If simulations ever occur, there will be many more of them than there will be original universe. And if you happen to be living in a universe, chances are, if simulations ever occur, that you're in one of them. I mean, that's the simple version. And if simulations do occur, you know, do they occur in a time that we're in, or in a time later than we're in? Well, they show up later, because we don't have them now. So in fact, the future that led to our ability to simulate the entire universe has already occurred. I don't know how much time that is from where we are now. Decades, centuries, I don't know. A millennium, probably we wouldn't need that much time. But the point is, whoever the original humanity was, or whoever's running the simulation, they reached that point. They got to the future. And they got interested in looking at variations on, or just recreating, the process that led them there. And they started creating computer simulations of their universe. We're living in one of them. Now we're heading towards, quote unquote, the future. But in fact, the future already happened. The future happened, and that's the only reason we're even here talking about the future, paradoxically enough. What do you think, Stephen? Do you think the future has already happened?
It's fascinating. Philosophically, Phil, whenever this subject always comes up, I say, well, how does it affect our, you know, our daily life, though? I mean, if it's true that we're living in a simulation, you know, can we freeze program, you know, call for the arch, like in the holodeck?
Yeah, exactly.
No, we can't. And so philosophically, it's an interesting thought experiment, but I'm not sure, you know, what it really does as far as for us as, you know, in our day-to-day lives. I don't know. I'm not trying to rain on the parade, but that's always been a thought of mine as to, well, you know, so if it is a simulation, what does that mean for us? You have any thoughts
absolutely. I mean, think about someone you know who has passed away, right? Who never heard of the simulation hypothesis, right? They lived their whole life in a computer simulation. Did it matter? Guess not, right? I mean, from that perspective, what difference does it make? What difference does it make? Now, I think if you become aware of the fact that it's a simulation, and I'm just speaking for me here, philosophically, it becomes different. At that point, it does matter, because it makes you think about what your past is and what your future might be in a different way. Even if I personally can't have any practical impact on that, even if I'm not going to change any of that, and even if I don't end up doing anything differently. Although I think ultimately my life is a little bit impacted by the simulation hypothesis, and I'm probably in some ways a different person, and some decisions I've made have been different. But ultimately, I think that if you're aware of it, yeah, it does make a difference. And at some point, there was an original group, because think about this, Stephen, the original humanity, if we're not them, right, they had the simulation hypothesis too. And they tested it, or, you know, maybe there's no way ever to test it, but they built the first simulation without knowing for sure whether they were in a simulation or not. Even the original humanity wouldn't know that for sure, would they? But if the idea of it inspires you to then go on and create simulations, and in fact, if that very process is what has enabled our universe to exist, then I say, yes, once you're aware of it, you really need to get a hold of it and then go with it, because our very existence may depend on the fact that somebody else did. So that's my why the simulation hypothesis matters. If everybody ignored it, we might not be here. So that's the best I can do. What do you think?
Okay. All right. I accept that.
Yeah, fair enough. Or we could do a whole show arguing about that, right?
Yeah.
But that's as close as I can come. All right, what do you got for number four?
Number four, various things on a chip, labs on a chip, antenna on a chip. These are all things that will make these devices, these do-everything devices like our smartphones and tablets and eventually wearables, be so much, you know, have so much more power to do things like monitor our health. A thing like an antenna on a chip would allows the range of these devices to be improved and to and also to save on power. You know,
very nice.
You know, and so, anyway, these are great technologies that are have to be done at the molecular scale. Have to be built at the molecular scale, and so, but it's. That's things to look forward to. The smartwatch that not just monitors your pulse, but your can give you a real time readout on what your blood sugar is, and other aspects of what's going on in your body. The testosterone seemed a little low today. All sorts of things that the quantifiable self movement really would embrace. You know, I mean, if you can monitor these things, you can improve these things. And so,
absolutely, and it goes wonderfully well with your pinpoint precision medicine, right? It's like
exactly.
To really empower that. Well, let's get some pinpoint precise data on us as individuals, and for that, we need devices that we can just carry around with us that are always on, that are always taking the data, and that are always looking for ways to improve our health. And of course, health being just one of the many applications for the basic principle you're talking about there, right?
That's right. And it would improve our devices for virtually anything you want to use them for, not just health monitoring, but health monitoring would be certainly a part of it.
That's a big one. I mean, that's for a lot of people, that's increasingly an important one. But lots of other applications too. Well, the whole Internet of Things movement, I mean, we're really hearing about just this kind of wiring up of the world with little sensors, little chips being placed everywhere, and really kind of changing the nature of reality in some ways. But we'll have to talk about that in greater detail later, because we're down to our last two. And I'm going to give you my number five now. Thing you probably didn't know about the future is that the future may take us to the past. And I've got a link here. I will share this one. I'm going to find the other one, too, because it's too good not to share. But this was in the Daily Mail not too long ago, talking about can the past be changed by the future? A bizarre quantum experiment suggests time can run backwards. Now, this is really interesting because this has been addressed before, and a lot of recent experiments have said, nope, time can't run backwards. There's always been this question about that. Well, does time always, you know, there seems to be this arrow of time and it always moves forward, and then some people say, well, at the quantum scale, it can run equally well backwards as forwards, and then there have been other experiments that have said it can't. And the general consensus over the last decade or so was that time can't ever run backwards. But now we've got this experiment, scientists probing the quantum mechanical properties of single particles, and have observed that the particles don't have a fixed state until they are observed, and it puts us right back into this place where time seems to only be occurring when observed and under the right conditions, with the particles changing their state only due to the scientist's knowledge. The implication is very strong that time could run both backward and forward, meaning not only that the future might bring us to the past, but that the things we're doing now could be influenced by decisions made by future versions of us, which is almost a sort of a self-contained version of the of the simulation hypothesis. In the simulation hypothesis, our future selves create ourselves. In this idea, basically, our future selves are influencing and guiding ourselves. It's a creepy, almost wonderfully paradoxical idea. You can give yourself a headache thinking about it. It's by no means proved, and perhaps not provable, at least for the short term. But can the past be changed by the future? Maybe it can. And stay tuned to this program to learn more about that on the future. All right, Stephen, you get the last word on five things that people don't know about the future.
The opening up of space. How about a slow ride into orbit, Phil, aboard a space elevator? Carbon nanotubes have the theoretical strength to produce a space elevator, a ribbon that would allow us to take a slow ride into space, much safer than getting on an explosive rocket, right? And something any frail grandmother could take the ride into orbit and look around. So and once you get into orbit, the rest of the solar system opens up. It becomes very cheap to go anywhere else. And so we're talking about a space elevator now. How soon do I think that we'll have a space elevator? I think we'll actually have people a colony on Mars before we actually get our space elevator. But yeah, I think we'll put a 60 years on this. 50, 60 years, we'll have a space elevator.
50 or 60 years, we'll have a space elevator. You can take the slow trip into orbit. I love the idea of it. And if it's not an elevator, we'll do something. We're going to figure some trick to getting into orbit slow. Maybe it will be lighter than aircraft, right, that eventually get yanked into orbit. But there are tricks to suddenly going that fast, because ultimately when you're in orbit, you're going tens of thousands of miles per hour. But if you can, the paradoxical thing about the space elevator is you're just slowly moving up the thing. You might be going 1 mile an hour, right, up the space elevator, and yet somehow when you get to the top, you're blasting along out there in space, because one end is tethered to the ground and is apparently stationary, although it's not. It's rotating with the Earth. And just like the hub of a wheel versus the rim of a wheel, the spokes of a wheel, you've got that angular momentum up there at the top putting you into orbit. Well, I love it, Stephen. I love the idea of taking a slow trip into space. And I know we're completely out of time, but you were going to tell me real quick how all your ideas fit together.
They all fit together because I read about them all in an article called "Big Nanotech: An Unexpected Future," by Eric Drexler, and every one of the things that I spoke about would be the outcome of atomic precise manufacture, which is a fancy term that is what Eric Drexler refers to, you know, instead of nanotech, which is the old
word. The new politically correct way of saying nanotechnology. There you go. So
that's right.
So you snuck in a nanotech show on us while we were talking about things people don't know about the future.
That's right. So solar voltaic, that's dirt cheap, batteries that are 100 times better than the batteries we currently have, personalized medicine, labs on a chip, and your space elevator, all delivered by Atomic.
All brought to you by just one technology from the future, nanotech. And, of course, there are
right.
many other technologies coming, too. Stephen, well done. What's our music?
Our music tonight is SpaceX, Launch You Up. It is a parody of the Uptown Funk song, and it is hilarious, and I love it, and I hope you'll like it, too.
Launch You Up. Thank you, Stephen, for putting that together. Thanks for all the great topics. Thank you all for being with us. We'll be back with another brand new show next week. And until next time, live to see it.
SpaceX, we go bold. We launch rockets, we write code. This one got that much smell, that shot well, the straight master sheet. Rolling, controlling, pitching, y'all keep it steady. Got a target on a boat, on a pole. Had a miss before, now we're ready. We're too high. Make a falcon land and refire, man. We're too high. Load up your liquid oxy. Load up your hypercolic. Cause Drake Ghost Plus gon' give it to ya. Cause Elon Musk gon' give it to ya. Cause I'll take you up to sleeping in ya. Our satellites will make Wi-Fi spots. Launch and land and relaunch. Home loan it, boost back and land on a drone ship. Go to Mars, die on it.